Okay, so pretty good. Good afternoon. The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. We're going to have budget presentations today. I'll note we do have a quorum present of senators in the room, and you'll have binders in front of you, members. This is all of the information that you will need is in the binders, and if any additional information comes in, we'll give it to you as well. But there won't be any separate handouts at each budget hearing that we have. It'll be mostly what's in the binders that are at your desk. So let's go ahead and get started. The Civil Legal Services budget. We have Kathy Hockadall, it's Executive Director from Mid-Minnesota Legal Services, and Jean Lestine, Executive Director of Central Minnesota Legal Services. Come on forward, and if I mispronounce the name, let me know.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I know Kathy's, I got right.
Actually, today I have with me presenting, I'm Kathy Hockadall, I'm Executive Director of Mid-Minnesota Legal Aid. David Lund, who's the Executive Director of Legal Aid of Northeastern Minnesota.
Welcome, Mr. Lund.
I also wanted to take just a second to let you know that we have other members of our regional programs here. Laura Jelnick from Southern Minnesota Legal Services, Ann Hofkin from Northwestern Minnesota Legal Services, Floyd Panuski from Anoka Judicare, and Jean Lestine from Central Minnesota. Thank you so much for allowing us to present today. And first, though, we're going to start with David just sharing a few comments before I do the overview from the PowerPoint.
We thought we'd start with just a quick story of a case that my office handled, just to give you a sense of the human impact of the work that we do and make the concept of civil legal services a little bit more concrete. Our senior legal project was approached this fall by a woman in her 60s who was a disabled veteran who she lived by herself, had no living family. Because of her disability, she wasn't very mobile and had very few social supports. So she was very isolated, and she was facing eviction from the apartment that she lived in because the unit had a bed bug problem. The landlord agreed that she was not the source of the bed bugs, but because her disability made it difficult for her to keep up with housekeeping, he believed that her unit had become a haven for the bugs. So she contacted our office, and our attorney called the landlord, who we had worked with before and had a good relationship with. He agreed to delay the eviction while we worked on a solution. So within the space of a few weeks, we were able to reach out to MACV, the Minnesota Assistance Council for Veterans, to get her plugged in with various social supports. We were able to connect with the county to provide her with a home care worker to help with her housekeeping needs. Then we were able to find funding so that she could move out of the unit briefly while it was cleaned. The carpets were torn out, the unit was repainted, a new mattress was provided. And within about a month, the unit had been inspected, certified bug-free. The eviction was dismissed. She was able to stay in the unit. So she was delighted, both because she got to stay in her unit and because through the MACV she was able to connect with a number of folks who shared the veteran experience with her. The landlord was very happy because he kept a good tenant. She was quiet, paid her rent on time. And we kept the case out of court, so it didn't take up a lot of court time. And obviously not every case turns out that way, but I think it's a good illustration of the methods that we all use and the goals that we try to accomplish. And so then I'll let Kathy talk about how that plays out statewide.
Thank you, Mr. David. Ms. Hockadall.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is just a quick overview of what we're going to cover today, what we do, and the justice gap that I know you've heard about before, but I'd like to speak to a little bit again and a little bit about our current funding. We are free legal help. We are a network of nonprofits who provide this help to people with low incomes in all 87 counties in Minnesota. We only do civil legal work. We don't do any criminal work. And we focus on areas of basic human needs: housing, safety, health care, food, education, the things people need to have just the most basic success in life. We provide our services free, but we also have a lot of volunteers that work with us, and I'll talk a little more about that later. Volunteer attorneys, law students, paralegals, and then to provide our services, we also use a lot of online technology. Again, we help people with the most basic necessities for safety, stability, and economic security. The story told by David really illustrates the kind of impact, and that's just one area that we help people with is housing. We promote strong and stable families throughout Minnesota. We help people with disabilities and seniors live as independently as possible. And we also contribute to the number one core judicial branch goal of access to justice throughout the state of Minnesota. We do this by creating web-based services that anyone in Minnesota can use, and we increase efficiency in the justice system by keeping out unmeritorious cases. We don't take a case if it doesn't have merit, and as David illustrated, resolving cases short of going to court. And of course, if we do end up having to go to court with our client, the client is not pro se. They have someone to help them navigate the system, and that helps our justice system. I wanted to highlight for just a few seconds our focus on innovation and just one of the many innovations we really strive to accomplish. I know this committee has been interested in specialty courts, and Civil Legal Services is a partner in founding four of the courts around the state, and we've had inquiries about a fifth. The partnerships have to do with domestic violence courts, and these have been proven to reduce recidivism for felony-level offenders and help victims separate permanently from their abusers. The numbers are up on that as well in these courts. These courts are initiated by the partnership that starts with basically usually the county attorney and Civil Legal Services, the office in that area, and then also the courts obviously are brought in, public defenders, human services, and law enforcement, and all of them work together. The Stearns County Project, this has received many awards, both state and national, and actually in 2014 was awarded, was chosen as a federal national mentor court and given money to do training to help establish more of these courts in Minnesota and elsewhere. We deliver our services through six regional programs, and you've now met the leaders of most of those programs. Our regional programs blanket the entire state, but there are also about two dozen small specialty programs that provide services. Maybe they're focused on one county. Maybe they just do volunteer attorney work. The kinds of services we deliver are we help people by giving them full representation if that's what they need to go to court. We also do a lot of advice and what we call brief service, where we might help just negotiate something like David's story short of going to court, and we do provide a lot of education and self-help resources. The Law Help Minnesota, the lawhelpmin.org website is something I know we've had a chance to talk to you about before. It is available to everyone, several dozen low literacy fact sheets on typical legal problems that help not only low-income people, but anyone, any of your constituents could be directed there. In 2013, we served...
Ms. Hockendall, what is the pro-justice MN?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members. It is a website that supports volunteer attorneys across the state. It has a lot of typical pleadings and briefs, so many of the volunteer attorneys across the state. It also actually helps the staff legal services attorneys because we can put things on there that we can all mutually share.
Is that publicly accessible as well?
You have to sign up for it because some of the stuff isn't work product, obviously, but could be considered something we're a little more careful about sharing because it's strategically directed towards our clients. So, but on the other hand, I think we're pretty open to sharing most of the information we have. In 2013, we served over 48,000 Minnesotans. We don't have the 2014 data yet. We won't until the court accumulates it in March. We do establish an income test that I know you're aware of. For a family of four, that means they have to have a household income of less than $30,000 a year. And merit is something we look at because we really take seriously the resources we have, and we want to use them judiciously. The kinds of problems we solve, the biggest area is family and domestic violence. The second is housing, very close. And the third is economic stability. There are many miscellaneous areas we also practice in, but these are our biggest all across the state. Most of our clients are females. A significant portion of our clients are seniors. And an actually quite startling percentage of our clients are youth under the age of 18 who need our services.
What kind of services are you typically providing to the youth?
There are a lot of different services, but we help kids who are at risk, maybe on the run because of violence in the home, and we can help them in a variety of different areas. Maybe they need a private CHIPS petition, or they have a housing problem. They may be eligible for some kind of government benefit. In addition, in the Disability Law Center that is statewide and part of my program, helps a lot of children, represents children who might need help with special education problems and things like that. About two-thirds of the people we serve are served directly by the staff attorneys through the legal aid programs, and about a third are served through volunteer attorneys. So obviously, volunteer attorneys throughout the state play a very big role in helping our client community. The justice gap, I know you've heard about, but it's still there. We do unable to serve studies, as the result was in 2012, so in 2014, we once again only were able to serve one of every three eligible clients that called us. That means they were eligible by income and eligible by the type of problem they had. So we turn away as many people as we did 2 years ago. And that's actually why we're requesting an increase to help our service capacity. This is another indicator of the justice gap, and this too has grown in the past few years. There's one private attorney in Minnesota for every 365 potentially paying clients. There's one legal aid attorney for every more than 4,000 low-income individuals in Minnesota. Our state funding is in three different buckets. It all comes through the Minnesota Supreme Court. The largest bucket is the general fund appropriation that we're very grateful that you have supported in the past. And the interest on lawyers' trust account is also private bar money that flows through the Supreme Court. And then the attorney registration fee also flows through the Supreme Court. I wanted to highlight the interest on lawyers' trust account funding because it has so dramatically declined since the recession. At its high water mark, it was almost $4 million a year that went to the court to distribute for civil legal services. It is now about $300,000. With, unfortunately, not much of and maybe it's going to stabilize, but not much of an increase in sight. This slide shows the variety of funding sources we have. We will seek money wherever we can reasonably try to get it. Obviously, the state funding is critical for our services, but we also all apply as often as we can for federal and local grants and for foundation grants to the United Ways, and we also do private fundraising from not only the legal community, which is a strong supporter of our programs, but also from the general public. We work hard to leverage these resources, and especially the state funding is really important for us in leveraging resources because we have so many of the other grants we get are very narrowly targeted. That's kind of the way of grant funding these days. And so it is the state funding that really helps us develop the technology that we're able to leverage. For example, the Lawmen and ProJustice websites, document assembly programs. We have a new program we launched in 2014. It's called Minnesota Legal Advice Online, which allows volunteer attorneys to answer questions from their desk that are submitted online. It's only the third such program in the country, and we're very excited about it. We also leverage the resources by recruiting, mentoring, and training volunteer attorneys, and we get lots of law clerks and what we call legal fellows. These are often right after their first year of law, right after their graduation from law school, who will come work for us for either a very, very low cost or free for a year. And state funds are a critical source for matching federal grant money. Many of our federal grants require a match, a dollar-for-dollar match often. An example of that is the federal funding that comes to the state to serve seniors. We get grants, almost all of our programs, the regional programs, to serve seniors in our areas with critical legal needs, and we all need to provide match money to get that Title III funding. We'd love to see more closure in the justice gap, and to create service capacity to do that, we've asked for an increase of $1.034 million. That was passed through by the court in their budget, and we met with Chief Justice Gilday and Jeff Shorba about it before we submitted it. And in addition, it has been included in the governor's budget. We just found out the other day. We were very thankful for it. We hope that and plan to have this funding, if we are lucky enough to get it, to improve the lives of low-income Minnesotans throughout the state. We also will continue to work to increase public access to legal resources through the internet, through the Law Help website. And we believe we will continue to promote confidence in the justice system by providing people the service they need and ensuring efficient use of the courts. This shows how we blanket the state and gives you contact information for any one of us if you need help in your particular district. And with that, we would be happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I had the pleasure of meeting with these folks earlier in the morning, but I failed to ask them a question, and I was reminded of asking that question as you told us or described your funding sources. You receive federal money, you receive donations through organizations like the United Way. Do you use all of that money every year down to a zero base, or do you keep a reserve balance in any fund, and do you have an existing balance now?
Ms. Hoppenau.
That would be an in excess of what is needed for your operations that you're requesting.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, we are individual nonprofits that form a network that blanket the state. So, to be honest with you, I can't speak for the entire state. It's possible we could get that information from the Supreme Court, because they do accumulate data. They get reports every year from all of the grantees. What I can say, I can't speak to my program, and although we do carry a reserve, our board of directors has mandated that we carry a reserve of some kind. Interestingly, we actually always, from year to year, seem to also have a bit of a revenue expense imbalance. So our reserve is like constantly in a bit of limbo. Many of our funding sources fluctuate substantially. Foundations change priorities, so you may get a grant from a foundation one year, and you can't rely on it for the next year. And actually, when we give our proposed budget to our board in my program every December, we never include anything that we're not quite sure we'll get. because things can change so dramatically and so quickly. The state funding is has been very reliable in the broad sense for, you know, 30 years now. It obviously goes up and down. And everything goes, most things go up and down. One interesting thing, the one area that for my program has not varied in the past through the recession was the private sector donations we got. But that's only 10% of our budget, so we couldn't serve many people if that's all we got. I'm sorry I don't have a more detailed answer to your question. I can talk to the court about getting more information if you'd like.
Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I personally would be interested in knowing any account balances, even average account balances in these available reserve funds. Gives us a little better perspective of perhaps the difficulty you may have in maintaining your budget. And so if you could, I'd like to see any information that you could provide.
Mr. Chair, Senator Limmer, I'd be happy to try and provide you with some information and also to sit down and discuss it with you further.
Sure. It'd be fine. The door's always open.
I will say our budgets are often, you know, for example, my program gets about 70 different, has about 70 different funding sources. So it gets very complicated, but I understand your interest, and I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you more and try and get you the information.
Of course, reserves are a fiscally responsible way to budget.
Right.
Any other questions or comments? Ms. Hockadall, was there anyone else that you wanted to have make a presentation on behalf of the budget here?
No, thank you. We appreciate the committee's time.
All right. Thank you. Members, I will note that the Civil Legal Services budget request, an increase of $1.034 million, matches exactly the governor's recommendation as well.
Thank you so much.
All the money is routed through the Supreme Court for funding. All right. Thank you. And thank you, all of you directors, for traveling to be here with us today. I should have noted at the beginning of the hearing that these are presentations of the budget. We're not going to be taking public testimony on any of these topics. Once we do get to the point of having committee discussion about what to do with the budget, we will then open up the floor for public testimony as well. But at this point, these are just presentations by the agency so we understand what their budgets are. So thank you. Our next overview will be from the Private Detectives Board.
You're welcome.
Greg Cook, the Executive Director of the Post Board. And at some point, Dan Boyton, I expect, Office of Fiscal Administrative Services. Post Board listed here. It's the Private Detectives Board.
Stay.
Okay. Mr. Cook is the Executive Director of the Private Detectives Board. My agenda is miswritten. So go ahead. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Greg Cook, and I am the Executive Director of the Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. It is my agency's responsibility to regulate and provide oversight to the private investigative and security industry here in Minnesota. I understand that I have some limited time, so I have provided you with a detailed printout, a detailed handout that has some of our data and a summary of our activities. I have a brief PowerPoint in which I will highlight some of our activities and data in the handout. I'm going to ask you to shift gears here, as the numbers you will be seeing are much smaller than what you've been seeing the past few weeks. Our agency has appropriated $120,000 annually to provide regulation and oversight to the private detective and protective agent industry here in Minnesota. All revenues received go to the general fund. The chart on the screen shows the historical spending from 2002 to 2013. The next chart shows the amount of revenue generated compared to the appropriations from 2000 to 2014. The revenue is in light blue, and the appropriations are in red. In the past couple of years, our revenues have increased dramatically. In fiscal year 2012, the revenue generated by this agency was approximately $131,000. In fiscal year 2014, it increased to $180,000. This is a 37% increase. As far as the peaks and valleys you were seeing, for whatever reason, we've had fewer applications, which means fewer renewals, which equates to less revenue on the even years. As you can see, in 2014, that changed. In 2012, the low points seem to have been evening out, and the high points are reaching record levels. We're only halfway through the year, and we have some excessive renewals and anticipated added income for the next 6 months.
Mr. Cook, to what do you attribute that?
Mr. Chair, please repeat.
Yeah, to what do you attribute that, that cycle?
The economy would have to be the number one thing. We have streamlined some procedures and some processes to get the applications processed faster, but probably the number one thing would be the economy.
So these are application fees that you're referring to? So you're saying more people are getting into this field?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. And the companies that are coming in, they're also hiring many more employees. So with the increase in the economy, so comes the business aspect of the security.
Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
You may not also be used to seeing such a simple pie chart. 97% of all expenses go to payroll. This includes salary and benefits. The past year, I was fortunate enough to have an excellent assistant, Kelly Goralnik. She was an intern who became a student worker who I then hired as a part-time temporary administrative assistant. Much of what has been accomplished the past year is due to the work she has done. As of this coming Friday, her position will be eliminated as we have depleted the funds available for her position. 3% of our spending is for everything else. This includes everything from office supplies to postage. There are other expenses that our agency could incur, such as costs for OAH, Office of Administrative Hearings. We currently have two situations with that, in which that is a strong possibility.
Mr. Cook, let me back up a second. So how many employees do you have?
I have one part-time administrative assistant until tomorrow.
Other than that, it's just you?
It's just me. I do make use of some of the interns that we have, but yes.
Okay. Thank you.
On this next slide, I wanted to show you this to give a better understanding of some of the other things that private investigators do. I am a licensed private investigator, and when I tell people that, the first thing that they say is, you must be going around following people who are cheating on their spouses. This is not the main source of income for the private investigation industry. I put on the screen a number of various specialties private investigators are involved in. These are services requested by and a benefit to the public, businesses, and government entities. I myself am a certified fraud examiner. I specialized in investigation of employee theft, fraud, and embezzlement, external theft, and mortgage fraud. As you can see, other types of services, elder abuse, insurance fraud, locating missing children, these are the types of services you don't hear about as often. There is a need for these services, as not all law enforcement agencies have the resources or specialization to accommodate the needs of who is requesting it. On the security side, these services also augment law enforcement. Some of these service areas include school safety and security, nuclear security, hospital security. These services are predominantly visible in such public areas as schools, government buildings, nuclear plants, and airports. You have probably heard the labels Rent-A-Cop or Barney Fife. What people do not always realize is that private security provides essential public safety. In general, there is a 3-to-1 ratio of security officers to police officers, 13-to-1 in downtown Minneapolis. You can see on the screen some of the services and facilities that are protected by private security. Though I do not have an exact number, I can tell you that an overwhelming majority of our licensed private investigators and protective agents are current retired law enforcement and military. I wanted to show you this chart so you can get an idea of where our revenues come from. These are the original license fees and renewal fees paid by our license holders. They range from $800 to $1,900. It is worth noting these are the third, if not the highest, licensing fees in the country for these types of services. In some aspects, I think of license holders as clients or customers. The perception of these clients and customers is that they are expecting service for the money they are spending. The types of services we provide will be evident in the next few slides. This chart displays some statistics for what we have accomplished the past couple of years. Note that besides fiscal year 2013 and 14, I added a column that covers the first part of fiscal year 2015. I purposely did this so you can see that our activity is increasing. In the past 6 months, our agency has processed more applications, officer changes, training instructor certification, and penalties than in the whole previous year. The bottom numbers on the chart are in regard to unlicensed activity. This is a subject that I could talk for hours about. This is a serious public safety and consumer protection concern. Individuals and business entities are providing security services, sometimes armed, and investigative services without verification that they are qualified. This includes ensuring that they have a clean criminal background, have the required 6,000 hours of experience, are properly trained, understand the law, are financially responsible for liabilities, are not taking advantage of their clients, and more often than not, we are finding they're not paying their taxes. Some of the cases on unlicensed activity we have worked on include an unlicensed security company providing services to schools, including large high schools, a bounty hunter who is also doing security and investigative work with a substantial criminal record, an unstable individual who had a picture of him holding an AK-47 advertising security services on his website, an individual posing as a DPS investigator in order to get information, bill collectors posing as private investigators and harassing those in debt, numerous calls of elderly and mentally challenged people being scammed. Given the opportunity in the future, I would love to talk about this future to the committee.
Mr. Cook, how do you investigate those?
Mr. Chair, usually a report comes in from someone stating they see an advertisement or a member of the general public had sought and found them through that advertising and hired them. Sometimes from law enforcement, who in the course of their investigations, they question us as to if somebody is licensed and learn more about the licensing process and the statutes. But generally, it's from the general public.
And then how does your agency go about following up on those complaints?
Mr. Chair, we support law enforcement. So we do our research in putting together all the information that we can from the advertisements, what we find on the internet, what the claimant or the person that called us might be talking about, and we pass that on to law enforcement.
So it's pretty much you and the interns that are gathering that information, right?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
And then you hand it off to law enforcement for whatever further activity is appropriate, or does your agency have authority to take any steps?
Mr. Chair, our agency does not have authority to take steps. We're here to support law enforcement. More often than not, it is the person making the complaint that is to file a complaint with local law enforcement who then contacts us for more information. A lot of it is license holders who come across an individual or a company that's doing unlicensed activity, which doesn't make them very happy because they have to jump through all our hoops to get their license and pay all their fees. And when somebody is doing something like unlicensed activity, it's taking business away from them.
And then if you get complaints about a licensed security person, investigator, how do you handle those complaints?
Mr. Chair, that's a different subject. But we have a complaint committee. It is comprised of a representative of the protective agents from our board, a representative from the private detectives of our board. I sit in on the complaint committee as well as the attorney general representative. My job with the complaint committee, as it is with the board, is to provide them information so they can make decisions. So if a complaint comes to our agency, we do our due diligence in gathering all the facts and producing an analysis as it is and present that to the complaint committee, who takes it from there.
And then the options would be suspension or revocation of the license or no action at all, depending on the circumstances?
Mr. Chair, it ranges from no action at all. There are some situations which the complaint committee and the board deem civil matters. Somebody hired a private investigator and they're not satisfied with the product, the outcome of their investigation. That's a civil matter. Other matters are more serious. Again, I provide the information to the complaint committee. If the complaint committee finds that some disciplinary action needs to take place, they will make a recommendation to the board. That disciplinary action can range from everything from a letter of education and conciliation to a monetary fine up to $2,500 to suspension and to revocation.
Chairman.
Senator Limmer.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Is there a specific law in the books which would prohibit someone from representing themselves as a licensed detective, private detective, but they are not one? Is there a specific charge for that?
Mr. Chair, Senator, yes, there is. Our statutes are Minnesota statutes 326.32 through 326.339. I can't cite the specific paragraph and subparagraph and point, but within those statutes, there are some bullet points that state if you are doing these things, you must be licensed. So there is a very specific statute, and the violation is a gross misdemeanor. Okay. All
right.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Cook.
Here are some of the stats regarding those that do go through the proper procedures to get a license. As you can see, since 2012, we have gone from 282 license holders to 342 license holders. That's a 21% increase. Please note that every additional license holder increases our workload exponentially. The number broken down further is into 226 private investigators and 116 protective agents. A very important number to know is these license holders employ 7,500 to 8,000 employees. Our agency has to verify the background check, training, and ID issuance for each of these 8,000 employees. When I state there are 342 license holders, it is misleading as the real number we regulate is 8,000. Another responsibility is ensuring the license holders are receiving qualified training to meet their CEU requirements. Per statute, license holders must obtain 12 pre-assignment hours and 6 every year after that. Armed guards must receive an additional 6 specific to weapons and first aid CPR. This includes annual certification on the firing range for those who carry a firearm. We currently have 85 training providers and 930 approved training courses. These are our core functions, also known as our key services. I'm not going to go through the whole list, as you have it in your handout with some details. I do want to highlight a couple of items. As executive director, it is my job to provide the board with information so they can make decisions. Basic tasks that are involved with that. Applications. The one thing I find most legislators concerned about is the length of time it takes to process an application. The governor instructed all agencies to streamline procedures. We have done that. I can tell you that we went from an average of 14 months to 3 in processing applications. You need to understand that per statute guidelines, this is an extensive process. I have listed some of what we do in the handout. It is imperative that we ensure only qualified individuals obtain a license. Renewals. This is actually one of the most important. If a license holder does not have a current dated license, they can lose contracts, lose insurance, lose business and employees. Equally important is complaints and investigations. Overwhelmingly, our license holders are qualified and operate with integrity. As with any demographic population, there are some that make errors in judgment. Some of these investigations are extensive in the use of resources. As we are not online and deal with a lot of paperwork, our administrative task load is enormous. We do have a number of projects that are currently on hold due to staffing considerations. These items are currently stalled or on hold as we have to have the resources to further pursue them. Legislative initiatives. The statutes that govern our industry are Minnesota statutes 326.32 through 326.339. There have been some small revisions, but the last real review of these was in 1988. I have formed a legislative advisory group and worked with the board on identifying some of our concerns regarding the current statutes. We have come up with 51 points that need further analysis. We will be working on these for many legislative sessions to come. We also have a number of rule changes that need review. This situation is currently on hold as we have no legal representation to assist us with that process. Website review. Website revision. Our website is woefully outdated and lacking information and resources.
Mr. Cook, excuse me.
Mr. Chair, excuse me.
The Attorney General's Office, Public Safety Division, provides you with legal counsel. Is that right? They provide the board with legal assistance?
Mr. Chair, that is correct.
Okay. But you indicated that you are lacking some legal assistance to go through possible rules revisions and so on. Is that a role that the Attorney General's office can assist you with, or is their role more limited than that?
Mr. Chair, our Attorney General representative was instructed to have hands-off rulemaking. He is not to assist with any rulemaking. I am not familiar with the rulemaking process myself, but That was his instructions, and that's what we're left with.
Okay. So what does he do then?
He does come to our board meetings. He does provide advice as far as protocol goes, and able to tell us about the statutes.
And if there are disputes or proceedings relating to potential action against a licensee, does the Attorney General represent you in that too?
Mr. Chair, he does. He does represent us at Office of Administrative Hearings. That is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
With the website, as stated, it is woefully outdated and lacking information and resources. The plan is to work with DPS Communications and enhance it to better serve the public and the license holders. Online services. Currently, all our procedures involve hard copy paperwork documentation. This uses up a huge amount of administrative resources. An enormous benefit not only to applicants and license holders, but also to our agency would be if we were able to have applications, renewals, and training certifications done online. This would also allow us to produce some statistical reports for analysis. Application forms and instructional revisions. We deal with a large volume of forms. Our current forms are outdated and the instructions cause much confusion. These items need some extensive analysis in order to improve their desired results. Site inspections and audits. Currently, we review license holders every 2 years during the renewal process. We are finding out too late sometimes when a license holder is in violation. A recent review of a renewal produced 117 violations, for example. The plan is to randomly audit files and with contract and event security actually visit them on site to see how they're doing. Procedures manual. Our agency currently does not have anything put down in formal documentation on how to do something within our agency. As I have to rely on intermittent interns, it would be a great asset to have some detailed information to assist them with learning how we do things.
I suppose you could assign an intern to put together the procedures for the interns to follow, huh?
Mr. Chair, I'm actually doing something as that when I have interns come in, and I've been through a number of them, and the interns are great. I have them write up a procedure for what they're doing, and then the next intern, I have them read those procedures and see if they have any questions, and we revise it further and further as we go along. So I have some rough notes as to a procedures manual, but not a nice thick binder that gives them step by step.
At any given time, how many interns do you typically have?
Well, I can tell you currently I'm sharing two interns with missing persons and POR, Predatory Offender Registry. These interns do have limited hours. In the past, I've been fortunate enough to have an intern, during they get like 200, 400 hours that they're doing their internship. And a lot of that time is, part of what the BCA gives them is the opportunity to go out to agents and go tour prisons and go to crime scenes and things like that. So, half of that time is them doing other things. But I make use of them, and, the frustrating thing is once they finally kind of get it, they're moving on. But we've been very beneficial to have some of the interns we've had.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair. In preparation for this presentation, I came across a legislator's request to my predecessor to provide a comparison of our agency to others in the state. This piqued my curiosity. I used the data off of one of the state's websites and was able to put together some information. I would like to note that some of this data needs some further verification, but graphically this is accurate. There's a lot of
the construction going on in the cabinet.
No problem.
What construction?
There's a lot of apples and oranges here, but what I found is we are the second smallest licensing agency in the state. What I also found was we're the only agency without online capabilities. In comparing our agency to others, understand that some of them have a single application process and it takes 2 days to get a license. Some of them you simply take an exam. I'm also in the process of gathering data from my counterparts across the country. Out of the 50 states, there are 42 that regulate security and investigations. All indicators are that we are the smallest agency for our type of regulations in the country. That is all I have for you today. In closing, I would ask that if you get a chance, review our meeting minutes that are on our website. After the presentation, I would gratefully appreciate any further contact with you to help with any questions or concerns you may have, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions at this time.
Could you just real quickly tell us what your budget request is, and now that we have a better understanding of your agency?
Mr. Chair, excuse me?
What is your budget request?
I'm currently not making a budget request, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Dan Poitim with the Office of Fiscal Administrative Services. For fiscal year 16, Private Detective Board budget request is $122,000, and for fiscal year 17, it's $124,000.
That's the governor's recommendation, right?
Yes.
On the small aid,
Mr. Chair, yes.
Mr. Chairman and members, throughout the budget, the governor recommended 1.8% increase each year for general fund, from the general fund for compensation costs for the smaller agencies in the budget. And this would include the Private Detective Board, sentencing guidelines, the Post Board. And for the Private Detective Board, that comes out to an additional $2,000 in 2016 and $4,000 in 2017 for a total change item request of $6,000 for the biennium.
Where are you going to spend all that money? Mr. Boynton, did you have anything else to add?
No, just that base budget is $120,000 with the $6,000 each year, and actually only budgeted for one FTE. So. Okay, so that's it.
Does any questions or comments from members of the committee? Senator Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cook, was I correct in hearing you say that there's many new applicants to be private detectives in recent years?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is correct.
And do we have a reason why? Is there a demographic thing going on that we don't know about, or is it returning vets that are wanting to get in the field, or some romantic TV show about private detectives that everyone wants to be one? Do you know why?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator, as stated earlier, I think the economy has a huge part of that. The economy is improving statewide and nationally. Some applicants were having difficulties getting their licensure previously and have reapplied, and we've taken a look at it, and I presented the information to the board, and they were granted licensure. But again, I have to go back to the economy as the only reason. And also be advised, not having online capabilities and not being able to crunch the numbers, so to speak, to give you some more details, I would have to go through, 342 files to try and nail down some other things or put out a survey to the private investigators, whatever it is. We do not have we have a large number of veterans that are license holders, but they've been license holders for a while. We do have some new vets coming in, and we expedite those applications. But again, it's the economy.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lemmer.
If you look at it in a supply-demand type perspective, are corporations or private citizens seeking services of private detectives more, and that may in a delayed manner trigger more need for, and maybe the market senses it? I don't know how we track that type of thing, but maybe you have a better idea.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator, the past few years with the economy not so good, a lot of corporations, businesses, insurance companies cut their own funds for investigations, for example, and security. And what happened was there was a lot of fraud cases kind of left to fester. With the economy improving, they're getting those funds back, and now they seem to be requesting those services more with the improvement of the economy. Okay. And I'm not seeing the crime rate rise or anything else like that, if that's your question, but it's simply a matter of numbers.
And, Mr. Chair, one last question.
Senator Lemon.
In your graph with other agencies in comparison, you made a comment about not having electronic means to file for licenses. Is that correct? And is that part of your budget request now that you would want to go in that direction?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have no online services with the other agencies. applicants or license holders or somebody doing training can actually get online and literally in a few minutes provide the information needed by the agency to process their renewal or their application, whatever it is. What was the second part of the question? I'm sorry.
Senator Lumber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this part of your budget request to go in that direction, to have that means capable of doing that?
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have been looking at this situation, and it's part of my wish list. I had contacted Representative Minnit, and to get some numbers, and they informed me it would take $250,000 to initially implement such a system online, and then a large amount of money, they didn't know at that time, to maintain it. I then contacted e-licensing. And frankly, I'm not getting some exact numbers from them, but they had told me it would cost more than $50,000 to implement the licensing and approximately $16,000 to maintain it every year. And there was a whole bunch of unknown numbers. There would also be a surcharge that would be charged to the license holders to use the e-licensing. And as stated, we have some of the highest fees in the country right now, and to add on to that, it's like a 10% surcharge, might not make the license holders very happy.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Lumber.
Just do simple math, and you got maybe less than 400 licensed individuals that have this license, and then to spend that much money for just to accommodate 400, it's hard to justify. But I am kind of concerned that we are kind of staying back in the mid-20th century with an agency.
Mr. Cook.
Mr. Chair, Senator, mid-18th century, actually. But again, you know, you're looking at the number of license holders, 342. They represent 8,000 employees. We have to manually go through what's called an affidavit of training and some other documents to ensure they have their background check done, they've completed their training, they have their ID issuance done. That's a lot of work paper-wise. And these employees also, you know, exponentially, they add work to us as they feed us a lot of complaints. You would ask about complaints earlier. A lot of employees complain that they're not receiving their training or whatever it is. But again, that license holder number of 342 can be misleading. It is 8,000 people that pass through our doors, so to speak.
Mr. Cook, how many hours a week do you work?
Mr. Chair, you don't want me to answer that. I do put in excessive hours. I'm not going to be modest here.
I'm not asking you to be modest. It's kind of a serious question.
The serious answer would be, I'm going to say 60 to 80 on average. There's things such as preparing for this where you put in a little more. And we do have some situations in regards to some investigations that we've done that have taken excessive amount of hours. And we have statutory requirements. These applications, these renewals, some of the situations that are involved with our investigations and working with law enforcement, there's deadlines. So you do have to stay there late at night sometimes. You do have to come in on weekends. You do have to bring work home, or it's not going to get done.
I'm going to ask if you would provide us, please, with cost information if you were to add a full-time administrative assistant to your office.
Mr. Chair,
that is. Give it to me right now, but at some point, if you'd provide that to us, or provide us with some kind of a staffing request as well.
Mr. Chair, I can actually give you that number right now. It is $65,000 for an administrative assistant, and that includes benefits.
And if you were going to add any help in the office, is that where you would want it in the form of personnel, as opposed to any of the others on your wish list?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Not only would they be an administrative assistant, they would be somewhat of someone to do research. There would be a number of things they'd be doing, yes.
Thank you. Any further? Senator Sharon.
And you're responsible for doing background checks, correct? Did I hear you talk about doing background checks? Is there a way to align that background check process with other mean, there's an enormous background check effort made through the Department of Human Services, and they've really improved and made a much more sophisticated system where you don't have to repeat the background checks over and over and over again. Is there a way that you can contract or transfer some of those obligations over to that system that's been built and developed, and it's just a matter of doing more of the same thing? I would just wondered if it might get some relief to your agency and take advantage of the resources that are being expended in the Department of Human Services. They do a pretty thorough investigation, and they've developed a system, Senator Latz, where it's kept. There's a bank of those. I mean, I think that came through this committee. If you remember correctly, Mr. Kerber was here, and they keep a bank of these background checks, and they get updated automatically so that a person doesn't have to go through the process over and over and over again. So it's just an idea to help your agency, because that number of hours, I think, it's really wrong to have somebody have to put in that kind of work to get to meet the obligations of the office.
Mr. Cook, have you explored that as an option?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we haven't explored that particular option, but I do appreciate any ideas. I am housed in the BCA, where we were able to do those background checks, but understand that the criminal background check itself is not time-wise, is a smaller part of our background investigation. We do a thorough internet review of applicants. They have to provide references, signed affidavits proving they have the 6,000 hours from former employers that we talk to, personal references. The applicant is posted, and sometimes we get calls from somebody who wants to give us information about that applicant. The application file is fairly thick, and the processing the criminal background check through the BCA is not very time-consuming. I spoke of our statute revision, things we were looking at in regards to the statutes to improve. One point of frustration right now is that our applicants, these are the people that are going to become license holders. Per statute, we can only run a BCA statewide background check on them. Now, if we have an applicant that's from out of state that's never stepped in foot in Minnesota, we might not find something. So one of the things we want to revise is being able to do an FBI national background check on these applicants.
And that's the same thing in the Department of Human Services. So
there's actually some, Mr. Chair, Senator, there's actually some, you have to have the U.S. Attorney General's approval of the verbiage written in your statutes to do it. So, and our Attorney General rep is assisting us with that, but that's something that's going to be in the future down the road. Maybe next fall we'll pursue it. Did I answer your question?
Yes, thank you.
All right, we want to make sure we have time for the guardians ad litem. Any further questions for the private detective board? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate this.
The guardian ad litem board, please come on forward as soon as there's space available. Go ahead and start whenever you're ready, and state your name for the record as well.
All right. Chairman Lotz and members of the committee, my name is Paul Nelson. I am a senior judge of district court and am currently the chair of the guardian ad litem board. A little bit of background about my experience and how I ended up as chair. I served, I worked in rural Minnesota my entire legal career in the 8th District, 21 years in private practice, a portion of which included family law. I was appointed judge in the 8th District by Governor Carlson and served there with my chambers in Montevideo. During my tenure on the bench, I served as chief judge of the 8th Judicial District, and one of the duties that I was given while I was on the Judicial Council was to chair a guardian ad litem advisory committee, which had a broad mandate of examining the entire guardian ad litem program as it existed in Minnesota, make recommendations to the Judicial Council to address issues, systemic problems, and move the program forward. After I retired and after the board was established, I was asked to join the board as a member. One of the things that, and I know Ms. Allegro will cover it in some detail, the guardian ad litem program is one that has undergone a great deal of change in the recent past. One of the recommendations of the guardian ad litem advisory committee was the structure of the program. The ultimate decision was to move the program entirely out of the judicial branch, although under the umbrella of the judicial branch, to be an independent agency, primarily to avoid some potential conflicts of interest. And as a result, in 2010, legislation was put together and the board was formed. I was involved in the committee that prepared some of those that legislation. As a result, the board and the guardian ad litem program, as it comes before you today, is different than in the past, because we were just previously a portion of the judicial branch budget under our line item of mandated services. We still have those mandated services. We still have the same pretty much statutory obligations, but we are now totally dependent, with the exception of some reimbursement money, on the legislature for our program. For details, I'm going to turn it over to Sue Allegro, who is our program administrator. To my left here is a fellow board member, Wright Walling, who has been with the board since it was established and is a senior family lawyer in Hennepin County. So I'll turn this over to Sue at this point.
Ms. Allegro.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Suzanne Allegro. I'm the program administrator for the State Guardian Ad Litem Board. The common mission of both the board and the individual guardian ad litem is to provide quality advocacy in each individual case to which a guardian ad litem is appointed. And the board's purpose is to administer that statewide independent guardian ad litem program. And also, we feel our purpose is also to provide better outcomes for children. The State Guardian Ad Litem Board supports the statewide outcome of strong and stable families by giving abused and neglected children a strong and independent voice in court proceedings. As Judge Nelson mentioned, the program has undergone significant, almost continuous change over the past 20 years in the areas of development and administration of standards for recruitment, selection, training, complaint processing, and oversight. I think, way back when there were 50 different guardian ad litem programs which were county administered, transitioned to district-based, and then state funding, and then with the legislation that Judge Nelson referred to, moving the program out from under the court system and putting it under the independent board. A couple of the things that the board has done since we came into existence. In 2011, we did establish our program requirements and guidelines in areas such as qualifications of the guardian, recruitment and selection, training responsibilities, complaint processing, precluded roles, and continuing education. In 2012, we conducted a stakeholder study. The last one had been done in 2006. We had the results were, on the whole, very favorable. However, there were two areas that we chose to concentrate on based on the survey results. The first was to ensure we had adequate contact with the children we were representing. And the second one was to ensure that we were making independent reports. In order to address that, we revised the juvenile court report format that the guardian uses to detail their investigation and recommendations to the court in order to make it more child-focused. We've had that in existence for a couple of years now. We've received very positive comments.
Mr. Chair.
In 2013.
Sorry, excuse me, Mr. Legge. Yes. Senator Champion.
I just have one question, and I wanted to ask this before you got further into your testimony. You indicated and that the goal or the purpose of the Guardian Ad Litem Board is to develop, you know, strong and stable families and communities by giving abused and neglected children a voice to be heard throughout court proceedings. And I'm reading that in your purpose, but in your testimony, you inserted the word independent. And to kind of set this up, it is my understanding that that was part of the restructuring of the board from the judicial branch because you wanted it to be much more independent. And so my question is, can you tell me how do you measure the desired work of the board to what actually happens on a daily basis in court, especially when we think in terms of child protection cases?
Ms. Allegro.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I think there's a couple of areas with the independence. One is the board itself is independent. The other way we use the word independence is the guardian ad litem is independent of any other county agency when we make our recommendations. As far as ensuring that the work we do, as I understand, are we actually achieving our mission, is we have done, as I indicated, the stakeholder surveys. We also have recently developed 19 child outcomes that we're in the process of developing a new case management system. We've developed 19 child outcomes that we will measure to ensure program effectiveness, and we hope to get that that will be implemented this year. Additionally, there are a number of the districts that use a collaborative review process where they do provide surveys to parties in a particular case after the case is over, and then they use that information that's more directed towards an individual guardian ad litem. So we also use those as well.
Mr. Chair, just a follow up.
Senator Champion.
Can you identify who the stakeholders were that participated in the survey for the guardian ad litem board?
Mr. Chair, Senator, you know, the judges, social workers, parents, attorneys. Those would be the primary ones. For the collaborative reviews, we do use the parties that are actually part of the case. So that would include, you know, if the parents, as well as the attorneys and the judge.
And lastly,
Senator
Mr. Chair,
Champion.
I would be interested in knowing more about your survey and getting the results of that and seeing that. Along with understanding how you implement or even solicit individuals to participate in the collaborative review process. Because I, as a part of my practice, do some work in, you know, child protection cases. And I've seen the guardians work. And so I haven't always seen this notion of independence. Mm-hmm. And nor did I know much about the collaborative review process, so I would like to know more about that because I do have some concerns.
Ms. Legro.
Mr.
Chair. I must say.
Do you follow up over here?
Yeah.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Legro. We worked together on a pretty sticky case. I guess my question is how much power do you actually have? Because the case we were working on was 22 women that complained about one guardian ad litem, and the base, and you had an independent review of this particular guardian, and all that happened is basically he was the supervisor said that he was going to be told to change his behavior or whatever, but that no hard evidence came up because all it was the basic testimony of 22 different people. So I guess I would like to know the extent of your powers. Are you able to actually go in and fire a guardian ad litem or get rid of them if there was just a significant amount of complaints, just significant. And as far as I know, he's still practicing. So I guess I would like to know how far can you really go?
Ms. Allegra.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we do have the Guardian, we do use both Guardian employees and volunteers, and certainly and the volunteers are used primarily in Hennepin County in child protection matters. The volunteers, obviously, if we have concerns about the performance, we would treat them a little differently than the employees. The employees are, Guardian ad litem employees are part of a union, and as such, we do need to follow the grievance procedure. We, in particular situations, we have hired independent investigators to look at complaints against a particular guardian ad litem. In some of the instances, the complaints have gone back a number of years, and so there have been areas that perhaps were identified as problems and correctly acknowledged that they were problems, but they had been addressed because they had been several years back. But certainly, if there was something that an investigator found were problem areas, that we do have the authority to take disciplinary action against an employee guardian ad litem.
Meaning, that you can, you know, I think there's some misconception about union employees. They can be fired, particularly when there are numerous complaints about them. But I'm just wondering, does that disciplinary action include making sure that they don't practice again, that they don't, that I believe this person is an employee. He's not a volunteer. So I'm just wondering, are you able to go in and say your recommendation is to relieve him of his job?
Ms. Allegra.
Mr. Chair, Senator, if we did receive the results of an investigation that indicated it was severe enough to call for termination, we do have the authority to terminate, and we would go through the grievance process.
Senator Sharon.
I'm sorry to be disrupting the presentation, but I think this would be great to have a chance to interact with you and focus. I think we can read the summary here. And I'm interested, of course, because we're in the midst of reviewing our child protection system and any element of it that feeds into the continuum. This guardian ad litem, if I understand it correctly, is appointed at the point at which a child is going through a traditional determination of whether or not there is a finding of neglect or abuse. Is that correct? And they are an advocate for the child's voice. So I want to make sure I'm clearly understanding that. And I'm very concerned about the guardians are recruited, mm-hmm. and what their requirements for qualifications are and how diverse they are in relationship to the population that they're representing.
Ms. Allegra, or
I would like,
Judge Nelson.
Chairman Lotz, Senators, I would like to just respond briefly with regard to a little bit of the complaint issue. One of the things that the board is currently involved in, there's two major issues that we're trying to address. One is our complaint process. We believe that a more robust, more transparent complaint process is appropriate. We have already begun the process to do that. Do not feel that, under the current system, program administrator is the final determining factor as to a complaint. We're going to move out of that.
Excuse me for interrupting. Just to make sure I know what you're talking about, the nature of the complaint that you're talking about at this time is a complaint. What's the complaint you're talking about?
The complaints, Chair, Senator, the complaints that we receive are oftentimes post the case, post decree type of matter, and they're investigated. We keep records on that, and it may be worthwhile to note that the records that have been kept by the board since January 1st of 2011, we've received 115 complaints. 14 of them were found to be meritorious. 101 were found not to be meritorious. Keep in mind that what we're looking at is malfeasance and nonfeasance. Some of the complaints come in because of the result of the case. Those really are not what we look at. That's really what the court is doing. Of those 115 complaints, however, 82.6% come from family court and not child protection. We have two levels of appointment under the statute. The mandated requirement is for a guardian to be appointed in all cases where there is child abuse or neglect alleged, the CHIPS cases, and domestic violence cases where the child is alleged to being abused. Those are mandated. The court has the power to appoint a guardian in a family law case, a permissive appointment, as you would, to have the court have the guardian advise the court on parenting time and custody issues where they are disputed. So the vast majority of our complaints come in the non-mandated portion, the family law portion of the work that we do. They are they're not totally separate, but you need to keep those two elements in mind. You are absolutely correct that in our budget issue here, this budget was prepared as required last year before the formation of the Governor's Child Protection Task Force. Any changes and any recommendations of that task force that increases the number of child protection cases will dramatically increase our requirement for providing services in those areas. So we take these complaints very seriously. We are trying to make sure that we can respond appropriately. And yes, we can terminate, and yes, we have terminated.
Mr. Chair,
Senator Champion,
I know that time is of the essence, so I'll just make this last this comment, and probably more so for my good friend Senator Sharon, because I know you are embarking upon something that I believe to be very important, and I would hope that you and I will get a chance to talk about the practical implications of some of the language that's articulated in the in your bill. Like, for an example, our good testifier here has indicated that a certain percentage of the cases or complaints that came was a direct result of someone being unhappy about the outcome of a case. And I would venture to say, just even from a practical perspective, that I would challenge that. Is because you can make a complaint to a guardian ad litem about their lack of independence because they haven't gone out to visit a home, because they haven't done some things that they're supposed to, and then the retort that you'll get back is, you're just unhappy because I didn't side with you and I sided with the county attorney. That's not the issue. The issue is, if you haven't done the work in order to be independent, you can have a separate board, you can have all the trappings of what looks like you're independent and not be independent. And especially when they come into a courtroom and we have a belief that they're articulating something that is in the best interest of a child or a child in this context, but they have not done the work. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if you say you haven't done the work, then they frame it as you don't like the result because I was with the other guy. No, I don't like the fact that you haven't done your work. And that has happened on more than one occasion. It happens all the time. And I would love to have that discussion with you. That's why I asked about the stakeholders, because you can, you know, ask certain people who will always say you're doing a great job, especially if they feel like, for me, you're doing a great job. Because your lack of doing your inability to do your work is always going to work to my benefit, and so I'm just concerned about that. And I don't want to paint the picture like all guardian ad litems, because there are some very good ones, but unfortunately, I've seen more that haven't done their work than those who have done the work, and therefore it impugns the context in which we are having a discussion about what's in the best interest of children. And thank you, Mr. Chair, for just allowing me to be able to say that.
And Senator Latz, I would just Senator say to you that, and when we're talking about the governor's task force on child protection, nothing, we haven't moved. My questions are not because they relate to a current recommendations of the task force. We haven't moved very far at all in the continuum of these steps that occur. We're quite a ways away from where we would get to a place where there's a traditional investigation and a finding and a court proceeding. So I'm just learning about this with this discussion in mind in the future for us. So there's nothing that we're doing right now as a recommendation that relates to this part of the child protection system. We will, but it's not yet.
If I might.
Mr. Walling could address.
Mr. Walling.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I just by way of background, for the last 42 years, I've been doing what Senator Chapman indicates and been sitting in every various position in juvenile family court. And I think two things are critical if we're going to talk about the background here in history of guardians. One, to follow up on your comment, guardians do not come into the picture until preliminary investigations and a decision by the entire bureaucracy of child protection to go to the county attorney and then come into court. We don't come in with initial investigations, and in terms of the current political issue, had asked to be involved more in the investigation that committee, and that was declined, unfortunately, from our perspective. But we come in at the end of the process in the sense of coming into court. Secondly, the pressure on the guardian ad litem program is quite substantial with regard to the extensive elimination of other resources in the court system. And particularly in the family court system, we are being asked in mandated case and also discretionary cases to do things which, A, are beyond some of the rules that we are allowed to do, and also should have been done, could have been done, used to be done by other people. The guardians end up the only independent from anyone else in family court cases, because in family court cases, it's the two parties against each other. There's no county, there's no child protection, there's nobody. So in the family court cases, the guardian is the only independent person looking from the perspective to try to help the court out. And so from our perspective, we do believe that our statistics show the majority of cases do come of complaints come from those cases where no one else is looking. The other issue from an independent standpoint, particularly in the child protection cases, is the independence of a guardian recommendation from a county recommendation. Are the guardians simply going along with a county recommendation? Sometimes the guardians believe that is the correct recommendation. Sometimes they don't. And, you know, we can talk about the issue of how often which happens and look at the statistics. What I can tell you is that the guardian board is extremely concerned and has taken significant steps towards involving guardians from particular communities, recommendations, other staff, it is becoming more and more difficult for the guardians to be the only independent, whatever, however you call that, voice in the court. So from our perspective, we are always open to comments, questions, and recommendations. But we also, in doing independent investigations, as Judge Nelson indicated, don't always find support for the comments or complaints that were made. That's why we're revising the complaint procedure.
Members, what I think we're going to do, this is obviously an issue that has generated some interest on the part of members of the committee and some input you desire to give, and I think it deserves a little more airing than we're able to give it in the context of this budget overview. So we only have 5 minutes left in the hearing. So what I would like to do is to ask the board to focus on the two pieces of the budget request that they're making, which are some increases, some substantial increases over current budget. And then we'll look for an opportunity to revisit some of these questions at a different forum, a different hearing in front of this committee, and ask members maybe to talk about what your specific concerns are. And we'll ask the board to also give us your thoughts on that. If there are suggestions in terms of increased resources or broadening of your mandate or training opportunities for guardians or whatever the situation may be, sounds like it's something that's worth
taking a look at outside of the budget context. Maybe that would dovetail in the budget, too. There might be some need for resources for that purpose. But let's at least for the next 5 minutes look specifically at the budget request, if you would, Ms. Allegro. Tell us what you're asking for.
Mr. Chair, we had two budget change requests. The first was to fund about $1 million operating deficit that we had experienced each fiscal year. This is due to a couple things. One is moving from one of the recommendations from the task force that the Supreme Court had on guardian ad litem, in addition to recommending that the program move out from under the court system, it also recommended that independent contractors no longer be used as guardian ad litems. Prior to that, the districts had either used volunteers, employees, or independent contractors. So I think it was felt for, in order to supervise the guardians better, independent contractors wouldn't be used anymore. The there has been a fiscal impact moving from an independent contractor to an employee model, even though their actual hourly rate of pay was decreased, that, you know, we are paying for things like insurance, FICO, we now pay for their training, that type of thing. And so it has added an increased cost to the agency. Additionally, there were costs associated with establishing an independent agency that we do have a staff of five individuals for the central office. And additionally, we do contract with State Court Administration for IT and fiscal services. Also, starting in FY12, we did have a cut to the base budget of $300,000 a year. And additionally, because we do have the mandates for the child protection cases and those family cases where it's alleged that a child is abused or neglected, there we are not handling as many of our permissive appointments. And those are the appointments where if a judge doesn't determine there's abuse or neglect, but there are issues with custody or parenting time, the judge may appoint a guardian. We do have a number of the districts have gone to waiting lists to just to because we don't have the resources to handle those cases. And then as Judge Nelson mentioned, we don't know at this point if there are going to be any caseload increases resulting from the governor's child protection task force. The other change request is related to compensation, and we're asking for an additional appropriation each year, and this is basically to address pay parity and reduce turnover. In when the guardians move from independent contractor to employee, based on the available money, we were not able to pay the guardians based on their level of service. So most of the guardians came in at the beginning of the salary range. So we are looking at, and this is something similar to what other state agencies have undergone when they've come into state funding or gone from a different organizational structure. Out of the 194 guardian employees, about 112 of them are not where they should be commensurate with their experience. Additionally, the program has, we have not had the money for any merit or step increases since 2009. So both of those issues were included in the compensation request.
And those are part of the governor's
yes, both of those were recommended to be included as part of the governor's budget. And this is the governor's recommending full funding of the agency budget request.
Okay, so for the compensation changes in total, they amount to 5% salary increases for each year of the biennium, is that right?
Mr. Chair, it was 5% plus the money for the pay parity. It was both of those.
Right, which yes. And the pay parity increase, is that included in the 5% each year, or is there separate from that?
Mr. Chair, it is separate. There's about for the first year, about $600,000 of that requested amount was for the pay parity, and the other amount was for the 5% salary increase.
Okay. And then you got you had a deficit as well.
Yes.
That was the startup costs and so on that you're referring
yes.
to?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay. And so there's, the request was to increase your starting base budget by 7.8% to cover that deficit, right?
That's correct.
Which is about $1 million in each year.
Yes.
Any questions from members of the committee at this time?
Come on, all these people aren't trying to go that far with it.
Okay, anything further that you would like to add to the budget presentation?
No, thank you for your time. We look forward to having further discussions. I think you will find that the board is responsive and very interested in moving forward. We are a work in progress. Quite frankly, the changes in the guardian ad litem program over the last 20 years, all of which I have seen either as an attorney or a judge, have been dramatic, and we're still seeking a much better goal. Thank you.
Thank you. That being the conclusion of our agenda, the Finance Division of the Judiciary Finance Committee is adjourned.
Thank you. Yeah, so that's pretty discouraging, Emmy.